Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So many stars, lots of alphas last night. Aaron Rodgers, Alan Lazard, Matt Stafford, Kenny Golladay, Steven Strasburg, Anthony Rendon. I could start with any one of these guys, but you know where I have to start, right? One name comes to mind, Cleet Blakeman. Please give it up for Cleet. On a night where the NLCS is happening, and that's going up against a primetime battle for first place in the NFC North, you have to be pretty special to rip the spotlight from all of that, and Cleet Blakeman and his crew did just that. You see, Cleet Blakeman does not just have one of the better names on the planet. He and his officiating crew are absolute stars. Bona fide stars. Just ask them. Because last night was not about the Lions and the Packers. Last night was about the refs. I mean, seriously, I know I touched on this yesterday. I know I mentioned it in passing about how bad the officiating has been this season. However, old Cleet and his crew went next level with it last night. Because throughout the season, the problem has been too many calls, too many flags, too much of the officials. Except last night was truly the breaking point. This truly is broken now because Blakeman and his crew went from officiating that game to ruining the game. I mean, I would love to start today's program by leading with Aaron Rodgers and talking about that fourth quarter drive, or Alan Lazard busting onto the scene. Except the officials were the story last night, and the league now officially has a crisis on its hands. Seriously, I mean, complaining about the officiating is one of the dumbest, laziest, most tired things ever. Or so I thought before last night. Because now I can't decide if the officials last night were dumb, lazy, or tired. I just know this. They were absolute garbage. Now, I'm not going to break down every single call they did or didn't make, but here are a few of the highlights. Starting with Lions DB Tracy Walker being called for that helmet-to-helmet hit when he was diving to make a play, diving to catch a pass. I mean, I know he made contact with Geronimo Allison, but what else was this guy supposed to do? He was trying to make a play on the ball. Walker himself did not exactly understand that call. He said, quote, "Extremely pissed off right now. It is what it is. Disappointed, hurt. We had that game. It's going. I'm going to say the same bleep. We should have won it. It is what it is, though. Got to bounce back." End quote. And if that's not good enough for you, he also had this to say.
Right now, from what I just saw, honestly, I'm just going off of bad calls right now. I feel like we left plays out there, and there was just some bad calls out there left out.
It seems like that's been a theme across the NFL.
Detroit versus everybody.
I wasn't even saying Detroit.
I'm saying Detroit versus everybody. It's awful.
All right, so he made that pretty clear. He's not happy about that. Detroit versus everybody. But there's more. Lions defensive lineman Trey Flowers getting called for illegal hands to the face on third down early in the fourth quarter. That call kept the drive alive for the Packers. They scored. That cut into Detroit's lead. And then there was the same Trey Flowers getting called for illegal hands to the face again late in the fourth quarter. That penalty kept a drive alive for the Packers. They went on to score and win the game. Flowers still cannot figure out what happened.
I thought hands to the face, but I had him right here in the chest. Second time I changed him to right here. That's part of a move that I do. So nah, I don't think they're coming, but they did. So.
All right, so what he's saying is, I understand hands to the face, but since when is hands to the chest a penalty?
Lions send four. Rodgers back, sets the pocket, pressure comes behind. Gonna get hit, gonna get sacked. Back inside the 45-yard line with a flag down.
Trey Flowers seems to be in disbelief.
Illegal use of hands, hands to the face. Oh. Defense, number 90. Oh. 5-yard penalty from the previous spot. First down, Green Bay.
What? Gotta be kidding. Trey Flowers working against Bakhtiari.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
He's got his hand not in his face. His hand is engaged with his chest. That's terrible.
Hands to the chest. Lions radio on that call. Illegal use of the hands. Hands to the chest. So we're clear on this. Flowers, is in his fourth full season. According to ESPN, he's never been called for illegal hands to the face before, but then gets called for it twice in the fourth quarter.
It's two for me.
It's two for Trey. Twice in the fourth quarter. And neither one was a good call. They were both terrible, just as pretty much everything else was that the refs did last night. Then there was that play in the second quarter when the Packers were lining up for a field goal and the Lions had 12 men on the field. The officials got that right. Good for them. Then on the next possession, the Packers had 13 men on the field and the officials did not flag that. And to make matters worse, this is one of those games where all the bad calls seem to go in one direction. Normally, I'm not a big fan of complaining about the refs because the law of averages would suggest that those bad calls even out. But they didn't last night. And here's the other thing. We don't need to be having all these terrible calls. There are solutions available. And don't look at me to come up with them. It's not my job to come up with them. The league is a multi-billion dollar operation. But the officiating looks like it's being done by amateurs. Normally, the officiating issues are about too many holding calls, never overturning PI calls, but Cleat and company found all new areas of incompetence to explore. I mean, this got so bad. It got so bad, even Barry Sanders was reaching for his phone. Barry Sanders jumped on Twitter. Quote, "I know that no one on the Lions can say it, so I will. That is a terrible missed call on hands to the face and a bad break for our D that is playing so hard. Hashtag replay help needed." Man, that is such a problem. That is a huge problem. If the league is serious about the game and the integrity of the game, and I'm not even going to get into the gambling ramifications of all this. I'm not even going to go there. But if they're serious about the integrity of the game, they need to do something stat. Because this is now a joke. This is now an embarrassment. And I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again right now. If this is how this is going to go, man, bring back the replacement refs. I mean, sure, they were out-and-out goofballs, and they were terrible. But damn it, they were our goofballs. They were a joke and an embarrassment and emblematic of the league's greed. But at least they were memorable. Who will ever forget the Fail Mary, complete with Golden Tate shoving the hell out of Sam Shields, followed by Tate and MD Jennings coming down with the ball at the same time, and one ref ruling a touchdown and the other ref ruling it incomplete? And who will ever forget that same ref showing up at a club in Fresno 24 hours later and taking photos with Packer fans? You can't tell me that's not an iconic moment. Problem is, last night we had lots of moments. None of them were iconic. This is week six. So we are well past the time where the refs are just working out the kinks or getting into the rhythm of the season or focusing on new points of emphasis. I'm going to break one of my most valued rules. One of my core principles, and I'm just going to say it, they're way past that, way past new points of emphasis. Now they just suck. Too many mistakes are being made. These are mistakes that can lead to players being cut, coaches getting fired, front office personnel being fired, and these guys making or missing these calls really do not have to answer to anybody. They don't need to explain their mistakes, and they don't need to answer to anyone. And speaking of explaining things, one more point I want to make. You notice how there's like a rules expert on every single broadcast? To me, that's not a solution. That's a part of the problem. The fact that the rule book and the way your guys are calling the game is so jacked up that you have to have an extra person available for every game to explain what the refs are doing, to me, is a huge issue. The rules expert is not a cool broadcasting technique. The rules expert is a major issue because the traditional football broadcast is the announcer who tells you what the players are doing and then the analyst who tells you why the players are doing it. But now you've got some third dude who has to tell you why the officials are doing what they're doing. And a lot of time, that rules expert's just up in the booth, just shrugging his shoulders. If you're the person who is responsible for the hiring at your company, you know what I'm about to say. Hiring can be tough. It can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but was having a lot of trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched on over to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates quickly. Take Dylan. He posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was incredibly impressed with how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. That's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in only a few days. With results like that, it is no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the very first day. Find out for yourself. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/clones. 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 ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And also, do not come in here and tell me the cameras are better, the TVs at home are better, and that's why people are seeing things better than the refs. All right, great. The technology's there. We have it. How come they don't? If that's the case, use the technology. Go to a sky judge, which, by the way, is a horrible term. If I can spot what should and should not be a penalty from my living room, let me do it. I will volunteer as tribute.
I volunteer as tribute.
I will volunteer as tribute. If I've got a better view and a better vantage point from my couch, let me officiate it. I mean, seriously. I mean, maybe not me because I'm pretty busy, but if your argument is that the refs get unfairly criticized because the TV audience has a better view, then give the refs the better view. Have an extra official working the game who's watching on monitors and can immediately jump into the ear of the crew when they huddle and tell them they're wrong. No, you know what? I got a better idea. Better yet, have a central place where there are hundreds of TV monitors where really good officials can monitor every game. Oh, wait. They already have that. And it still hasn't made anything better. So here's your number one piece of advice. From me to you, from me to the NFL, on officiating. Here it is. You ready? Get better. Do better. Do better. You've got a major problem. There are numerous solutions. Do something. Bleeping do something. Because burying your head in the sand and rolling out these same crews to butcher these same games is killing the game. It is. I mean, Barry Sanders? Is tweeting his frustration about the refs? Barry freaking Sanders, a man who never said a word while playing a decade on horrible teams, who never had a shot at winning, is now livid. Man, you got a problem, Shield. Fix it before your fans pull up Barry themselves and just walk away from the game. Chris Weidman is my guest. Chris, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So there's a lot to talk about, but before we get into any of the details, you posted on Instagram the other day you had your last hard workout of training camp. How was that workout, and how has the camp been overall?
Yeah, camp has been amazing. You know, I'm going up a weight class for the first time, and so I'm not cutting weight for the first time, and so my body's just stayed super healthy. That was one of the main reasons why I had to move up in weight, but my body was just kind of falling apart, cutting all the weight. So I feel so much better. And, the last workout we did something called a puke drill where you go from wrestling two different guys. So you wrestle one guy for 30 seconds to a minute, and then you go to hitting pads hard. And then you go back to wrestling a fresh guy for 30 seconds to a minute, back to the pads. And then you do that for five minute rounds. And it was a great workout, no injuries, which is always the most important. I like pushed a great pace and, I feel amazing. Camp has been great.
Chris Weidman joining us. You know, I would imagine, so your body feels great, but, like, what does that do to you mentally? How does your mind feel? In other words, when you don't have to make a big cut, how much stress does that add to the camp? When you don't have to do it, are you able to focus more on your technique and your training?
Yeah, and you also just get to, like, chill out more and put your mind somewhere else, you know, because I was always so focused on my weight and staying disciplined with meals. And then there you do something called water loading once you get closer to the fight, where you start, you know, taking tons of water with no sodium. You can't have any sodium in any of your meals, and then you start bringing down the water slowly, and then, you know, your weight starts falling off. But then you got to do like two hard cuts where you're doing like 7-8 pounds each weight cut. And it really like would break you down mentally and physically. And I was always positive about when I was doing it, because otherwise it would really suck. But now not doing it, it makes me really realize like, wow, this is amazing. I'm going in there feeling fresh. My mind is fresh. I feel like a new guy right now.
We're talking to Chris Weidman. All right, so at the top, I mentioned a number of the guys you've beaten in your career. You have been a champion. You have beaten Anderson Silva twice. I could argue that you've accomplished pretty much everything there is to accomplish in that sport. So what keeps you motivated, and what keeps you going?
You know, I think at middleweight, I think I accomplished everything I kind of wanted. And I think that was some of the problems. You know, I won the belt. I defended 3 times. And then the goal, once I lost, was like, all right, I just want to win the belt back and hold the belt longer. And I just kind of wasn't super excited about that, because it's something I already had. But to go up a weight class and to know that I could be a champion up a weight class, but not only that, beat one of the other guys that everybody thinks is the greatest of all time, John Jones, is something that really excites me. I love to have all that doubt and people to look at me, you know, and twist their head and think I had no chance, because that's what I was getting before I fought Anderson Silva as well. And so obviously, first thing is first, I got to make my statement at the weight class and go out there and do my thing against Dominic Reyes. But to have the opportunity to have a guy in the weight that everybody thinks is unbeatable is what really, you know, it creates a super exciting goal for me.
Chris Weidman joining us. I'm going to go back to Reyes in a minute, but since you mentioned John Jones, what about that? Because that's going to come up in every single interview. As you're fighting light heavyweight right now, there's already been some talk about the two of you maybe fighting at some point. So when you think of Jones, when you look at Jones right now, what are your thoughts?
He's kind of looked lackluster in his last couple of fights. He's failed a bunch of drug tests. You know, it's questionable. If, you know, is he a cheater, not cheater? I think there's an asterisk on his career. He's obviously very well rounded. He adjusts very well. But I don't think he hasn't gone against a guy with me who's as well rounded and who could, you know, bring pressure, a pace, not get tired with wrestling and jiu-jitsu. And, I just think I have the tools to beat him. I always thought that. I mean, the goal for me was always to fight middleweight, win the belt a bunch of times, go up to 205 and beat John Jones. That was always the goal. It didn't work out exactly the way I wanted. But here I am at 205, and I have the opportunity and the abilities to make it happen. So I feel great about that.
We're talking to Chris Weidman. See, that's the thing, right? You're moving up, but it's not like you're kind of easing your way into the light heavyweight division. You're going to come in and fight Reyes right out of the gate. He's undefeated. He's the number 4 fighter in that division. So what kind of thoughts do you have when you watch him fight, and what concerns you the most about his style?
He's a tough dude. He's hungry. He's undefeated, and he's got good footwork. He hits pretty hard. He has good kicks, southpaw, long. But he hasn't faced anybody really a wrestler yet. He was taken down 4 times in his last fight against a guy who was a striker. And so it's a different animal. Not just like if I take him down and he has to worry about submissions and ground and pound. It's a different animal, because on the feet, he's going to have to worry about the possibility of me taking him down. So it kind of ruins his whole stand-up game, too. It's going to really throw a curveball in there that he hasn't had to deal with. It's a lot different to multitask all those thoughts. So I think that's going to be the problem for him.
So let me ask you this. When you're fighting a guy who is undefeated, is there an argument to be made that he really has not been tested, and that if you can get him into deep water, he's not going to know what to do?
You know, I'm my goal is to drag him into deep water and drown his ass. There's no question about it. That's the goal. I'm bringing him to that spot, you know, where it's either sink or swim, and I'm not going to give him a way out. So, and I've been in these positions. I love being uncomfortable and tired and pushing harder than the other guy, and he hasn't been there yet. So I'm excited to introduce him to that.
Chris Weidman joining us. You know, that mantra is either you win or you learn. Like, when you look at some of the fights that did not go the way you would have hoped, what have you learned from them?
Oh, I learned a lot. I mean, each fight was so different that I lost, and it was different things I learned from each one of them. Technically, in the actual fight, preparation-wise, mentally, where I was at, and you kind of figure yourself out. You learn. You know, I became undefeated world champion at 9-0. I beat Anderson Silva, and I defended my belt, you know, three times, and I was undefeated, you know, world champion. And I didn't think I was ever going to lose. And I didn't have those lessons yet. Now from losing, I feel like I got so much better, and I learned so much more about myself and learned what makes me great. And now I just, especially going up a weight class now, I just have a whole new outlook on who I am and what I want and how I get there.
Chris Weidman joining me for a few more moments. You know, you mentioned that change. So when you go to light heavyweight, what about your approach? Does the approach change, or do you do what you've done at middleweight, and will that work at light heavyweight?
You know, I feel like every fight was different for me, even at middleweight. You know, it wasn't always the same exact, you know, strategy. But in this fight, I think the main thing is that I just, no matter what happens in there, I don't, you know, I miss a takedown, I miss two takedowns, I miss three takedowns. I don't stop. I just keep coming forward. I throw heavy hands. I get to my shots. On top, I look for control, then I look for submissions. And that's really like the basis of what I do, no matter who I fight. And yeah, so that's not going to change.
So
the only thing that really changes is that, like, the guys at 205 get more tired than the guys at 85.
Huh.
You know, so I'm excited to exploit that and bring a pace that won't stop in that weight.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to say, you had an interesting point recently when you were talking to Ariel Helwani about training to fight for five rounds, and the training for five rounds is actually worse than fighting five rounds. Lay that out for me. What is it? What's training for five rounds like, and why is that worse than actually fighting five rounds?
Yeah, because, I mean, everything is double. Everything's pretty much double what you're used to. So you're used to sparring for 3 5-minute rounds. And at the end of it, you're exhausted. You're laying out. You're drinking water. You know, you're dead. And then all of a sudden, you're fighting for five rounds. And somehow you have to find your way off the floor, get back up, drink water, and go right back up, right back out there, you know, in a minute. And then you got to do that again in the fifth. And so it's a mental, it's kind of messes with you mentally a little bit, and then also physically. Kind of got to reprogram your mind into, like, what level and what limits your body could get to. And so there's more chances of injuries. There's just, you know, you're training double what you're used to, you know, if you're not used to it. So there's a lot of curveballs with that. And, yeah.
It is a big fight coming up on Saturday. He is a light heavyweight now. He is the former UFC middleweight champ, 2-time NCAA Division I All-American, and that fight is Reyes v. Weidman Saturday. It is UFC Fight Night on ESPN. It's live from Boston. Chris, you do what you always do. You came in, you crushed it. Really appreciate that. Thanks so much, and good luck this weekend.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Jim.
1 out of 4 batteries are going to fail this winter. So you want to get yours tested for free during Superstar Battery Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. If it does need to be replaced, O'Reilly has the Superstar battery just for you. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. I really wanted to have led today's program by talking about the Packers and how they played and how they came back in the fourth quarter and they stabbed the Lions right in the heart. That's what I wanted to do. That was my plan, except the refs would not let me. So now, after an hour, I can actually get into the game itself, because that was actually a pretty interesting game. If you had any doubts about how the Lions were going to show up in primetime at Lambeau, they came to play, and we learned that pretty early on, because they opened up with a flea flicker on the very first play from scrimmage.
He gets the snap. He turns to the left. He pitches to his running back, who throws it back to Stafford. He throws the flea flicker pass over the shoulder. Catch Galladay, 30. Down the sideline, 20. He's inside the 15. He may have lost the ball when he hit the deck, but they're going to call it a completion to the Green Bay 11-yard line. A flea flicker to begin things. A 66-yard pass. And it's a great way to begin things for the Lions at the Green Bay 11.
That's Westwood 1. That was a brass way to start. I mean, that's nailing your colors to the mast, right? That's making a statement about who you are and what you're about. That you're not afraid. You're not intimidated. I respect the hell out of it. I love that play call. The only problem was, after getting down to the Packers 11 on that play, they had to settle for a field goal. And that was the theme the entire night for Detroit. For Detroit, that game came down to two things, actually. The officials and settling for field goals. Too much of the refs and too much of Matt Prater. Zero TDs and four field goals on their last nine possessions. That's a problem. As big a problem as the refs were, that's also a problem. And that's not one of those tricky situations where you can't entirely blame the refs for Detroit losing that game. If they convert some of those field goals into TDs, we're not having this conversation. We're not talking about the officials. We're not talking about the calls. Except I will say, the terrible calls did not help. You know what else did not help, Lions fan? Aaron Rodgers did not help. Down nine in the fourth, he went right to work. He was already without Davante Adams due to turf toe. Then he lost Geronimo Allison with a head and chest injury. Then rookie Darius Shepherd had a pass go off his face mask and into the Lions' hands at the one. So the story goes that Rodgers went to his receivers coach, Alvis Whitted, and asked, quote, if number 13 could come in for a little bit, end quote. If that's true, that's awesome. Because number 13 is Alan Lazard, who had been a beast at Iowa State. Then he went undrafted, and he signed with the Jags last year, but then he joined the Packers in December. And Aaron Rodgers apparently went to the receiver coach and said, hey, can we play number 13? Well, let me tell you about number 13. Going into last night, he had never caught a single pass from Aaron Rodgers in a regular season game. Not one. Then he caught four passes for 65 yards and a TD. And the TD was sweet. Roll it.
Shotgun snap is belt high. Rodgers gets it. Winds up long. Spiral arching pass down the far sideline. Over the shoulder catch. At the pylon. Touchdown! Lazard! 35-yard strike. And it was perfect by Rodgers.
It was perfect. What an awesome throw. What an absurd throw. When you hear people question why Aaron Rodgers is mentioned as one of the greatest ever, even though he's got just one ring, show them that throw. That's why. There's only one spot where that ball could go, and only a handful of guys who've ever played the game who could put that ball in that spot. And in case you can't tell, Lazard and Rodgers have chemistry. They might not have had a completion between them in a regular season game prior to last night, but these guys do have chemistry.
I actually sit next to him in the team meetings, and we've struck up a pretty good friendship. The thing that got me was what you love as a quarterback, and that's when your receiver's coming back and telling you he wants the ball and what routes he wants to run. You know, the big first down we had to him on the out route, that was him coming back in the huddle telling me what play he wanted. And for a young guy to do that, how can he not have confidence in that?
If you're a young guy, there's nothing you'd rather hear than Aaron Rodgers saying that. That he and I have chemistry. I sit with this guy in meetings. I know what he's about. He's doing the work. I want to get him the ball. Rodgers also said that Matt LaFleur had two play calls in mind.
I said, go with the first one because I'm going to throw it to Allen and we're going to move the sticks. And we did.
Pretty awesome. Allen Lazard rolls in off the bench. Again, having never caught a pass from Rodgers in a regular season game, yet he's telling Aaron Rodgers where he wants the ball, what routes he wants to run, and Rodgers is with him on that. To put another way, or in another way, Lazard said after the game, quote, I'm made for this bleep, end quote. And so is Rodgers. That touchdown to Lazard made it 22-20 with just over 9 minutes to go. Green Bay forced a punt. They get the ball back on their own 18 with 6:46 left, and everybody knew what was going to happen then. Rodgers was going to go down the field in the fourth quarter and win the game because he's made for that bleep, because that's what he does. And that's exactly what he did. 77 yards, 13 plays, including a clutch play by Jamal Williams to slide on the field when the Lions were looking to let him run into the end zone. And how many of you were pissed when you saw that? Right? Again, that aside, the Packers were not concerned about what you did, how you got down, who you bet on, and what you had. The Packers were concerned about bleeding clock, spinning clock, so Mason Crosby could come on and finish it.
The long snap is there. Ball put down. The right-footed kick is away and good! Green Bay has their first lead of the game. Crosby runs to the side. It will do the Lambeau leap. Zeros on the clock. Fireworks shoot. The Packers have won.
So, Lions fan, yes, you got jammed. Yes, the refs butchered that drive. Yes, the refs butchered most of the game. But you did not help yourselves at all with those field goals. And that Lions team is good. That's a really nice team. They're this close to being undefeated with wins over Kansas City and Green Bay. But the next step is to make sure they can slam the door shut on teams like the Packers when they had the chance. They got up on them early, they had a chance to finish, and they didn't do it. And obviously, if you give Aaron Rodgers any kind of shot at all in the fourth quarter, he's going to take it because that's what he does. And the Lions should have known that. We all did. So, Packer fan, what about you? You're 5-1 now. You're first in the North. You couldn't ask for a much better way to start the Matt LaFleur era in Green Bay, right? Your defense is a lot better than it was expected to be. And while the offense is not quite there yet, and they are banged up, obviously, they appear to be getting better and getting the kinks out every single week. The running game looks way better now and a hell of a lot more like LaFleur's roots than it did at the start of the season. It was going to take some time. Hopefully, Davante Adams comes back soon, and then this goes to another level. Hey, maybe you do have something good in number 13. There's a reason why Aaron Rodgers went to the coaches and said, put number 13 in the game. Life's got to be good, Packer fan. Life has to be good. 5-1, and you're still ironing out the kinks. Hey, Redskin fan, I haven't forgotten about you. You might wonder why I'm going to drag you into this. Redskins fan, I want to know what it feels like to know that you had LaFleur, Kyle Shanahan, and Sean McVay in your house at the same time. And you let all three get away. Redskin fan, don't say that I'm not thinking about you. Jerron Brown is my guest. Jerron, good to have you on. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Doing well. How's it going?
Good. It's great. It's good to have you on the show. Thanks so much. So you went on the road to Cleveland. You had an absolute battle for that win. How was that flight back to Seattle after a come-from-behind victory like that one?
It's always good to, you know, go back with a win. Of course, those cross-country road games. But I think that win was so important. You know, we want to continue to keep the slow streak that we got here going and get some momentum going into this week.
Now, obviously, the offensive line was missing a couple of starters. Yet, as an offense, you didn't blink. What's that say about the mental and physical toughness of this group?
Yeah, you know, we had a couple guys down, and I think that's going to be needed. That will be definitely tested, and you know, those guys is ready to come in and step up and without missing a beat. That was a good defensive line front, and yeah, you got to give kudos to those guys.
Seattle Seahawk, Jerron Brown is my guest. So let me ask you about a couple of plays from the game itself, starting with that 17-yard TD pass from Russell Wilson late in the second quarter. Can you take me through the play? What did you see on that play, and then how did it feel when you got both feet in bounds?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it was a simple check. Russ kind of saw coverage, saw it was no safety help. And, yeah, it was basically just a post-corner route. Yeah, when initially I didn't realize how close I was to the sideline until actually watching the playback. And, yeah, I just had to hurdle over like a cameraman. But, I mean, three, he made a heck of a throw. He took a hit, and, yeah, I just wanted to make the catch for him.
All right, so when you make a play like that and you have a touchdown reception like that, you got to celebrate that, right? And not just with any celebration, but you got to celebrate that in a special way. You guys broke out the NSYNC dance. Lay it out for me.
Oh, yeah.
When did you start thinking about that one? And then what kind of a grade would you give yourselves for the execution?
You know, everybody's been talking about the dance. Everybody's asking me who came up with that. You know, I would have to say I have to give credit to Tyler Lockett and David Moore. They both came up with that. And you know, I feel like David kind of messed up one of the moves. But I don't know. I have to look at the playback again. But yeah, it was always fun to celebrate.
That's funny, man. It's not as easy as it looks, right? I mean, you catch a touchdown like that, you got a lot of adrenaline pumping. You've got the emotion in the moment. You got to be peaking. So what kind of presence of mind does it take to make sure you execute the choreography correctly? It can't be as easy as
I know,
it looks.
It's almost like you got to calm down and you got to remember, okay, focus, focus, focus. Okay, remember the moves because you don't want to be that guy, of course, obviously, so. You know, we got to take a little pride in it. I mean, to be honest with you, we only actually rehearsed it probably a couple times right before the game. So to go out there and have that flawless execution is promising.
Jerome Brown joining us. All right, so then you come back in the second half and you score again, this time on third and goal on a play where Russ bought some time. You scrambled to the center of the field to give him a target. What was going through your mind on that play? How did that go down?
Yeah, I was hoping he'd see me. You know, try to get in the open area. They were in zone defense, and, yeah, just try to find open space. And, you know, he slung it in there and was able to fit in such a tight window. And, yeah, that was a heck of a throw by him.
All right, so he's having an amazing season, but it seems like some people still do not recognize exactly what this guy's doing. As somebody who works with Russ all the time and has a chemistry with him, what is it about him that makes him so unique and makes him so special?
I mean, just the way he works, the way he prepares himself. You know, first guy in the building, last guy out, of course. Just his leadership from that aspect. And, you know, he's just such a poised guy. We already know he's an amazing athlete, but, you know, just that overall feel and the togetherness of this team is really starting to come together. So, yeah, he deserves all the attention that he's getting.
All right, so in terms of the attention, is there any doubt in your mind that if the vote were held today that he'd be the league MVP?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
I don't see why not either. There's some other guys I can make an argument for, but if I had to vote today, I'd give it to him right now. So if you go back a little bit, Jerron, you played your high school ball in South Carolina in a small town. What was life like growing up there and playing high school ball there?
Right. I mean, yeah, small town, Sherrall, South Carolina. very football-oriented town. It was fun. You know, everything revolved around football. You know, I had the opportunity, obviously, stay in state, continue playing at Clemson, but... yeah, it was the same atmosphere, man. Real nice, one of those old football country towns. So I was able to, yeah, make a name for myself.
So in terms of Clemson, what was it like to be recruited by Dabo Swinney?
That was great. And I was thrilled once he actually became the head coach. It was such an easy transition because he was a wide receiver coach. So definitely knew they'll be throwing the ball a lot more.
We're talking to Jerome Brown. So you went undrafted, and that can be a tough blow from an emotional standpoint, but then you signed with Arizona and you went to work. What was your mindset when it came to showing up to camp and trying to earn that job?
I knew I had something to prove. I came in with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, you can say that. Undrafted, that's the hard way, you know. I knew that nothing was going to come easy, but I was prepared for it. So I think Clemson definitely prepared me for the NFL for sure.
So in terms of having something to prove, were you looking to prove everybody wrong or were you looking to prove yourself right?
I definitely knew what I could do. So I definitely probably say to everyone else wrong for sure.
Jerome Brown joining me for a few more moments. You talked about also learning from Larry Fitzgerald in your time at Arizona. Like, what kind of things did you pick up from him about taking care of business on the field and taking care of your body off of it?
Yeah, I mean, certain stuff just like – technique-wise, he's such a technician. He's not, obviously not the fastest guy, but just he can always get off the line, and he's always open. So just learn from that aspect of how to get open in general and just how to be a professional off the field, take care of the body, stuff like that. As a young player, I didn't realize, you know, the importance of it, and, you know, definitely helped.
So in camp, Russell Wilson talked about how he wanted to get you more involved. When you come from a situation where you were undrafted and you had to fight for everything to having the coaches and the quarterback raving about you, saying we got to find a way to get this guy more involved, like, how does that feel? Does it feel like you finally have arrived and you've proven yourself right?
Yeah, I mean, no. I wouldn't say that because it's definitely you know, a fight every year, really. Every week I'm, you know, trying to get better and trying to challenge myself to get better. So I don't think I'll ever get at a point where I'm like, hey, I arrived. But, you know, it's definitely good to draw some praise from the coaches and the quarterbacks. Of course, I'll take it. But at the same time, I'm always working, man.
Seattle's 5-1, and he had a couple of touchdowns in that win over Cleveland, undrafted out of Clemson, and getting an opportunity. Jerome Brown, my guest. Jerome, I appreciate it. Thanks for the conversation. Good luck.
Hey, thank you.
We all love to refresh our snack drawers, right? But when was the last time you refreshed your sock drawer? If you can't remember, it's probably time for an upgrade. Bombas socks are made with comfort innovations like arch support, a seamless toe, and a cushioned footbed. All socks speak for super comfortable. They come in hundreds of colors and styles, making them perfect for men, women, and kids. I love Bombas socks. I love the way they feel, I love the way they look, and I love the company and its mission. And Bombas has a new line of merino wool socks that are made from soft, warm, and naturally moisture-wicking merino wool. It's designed with all of Bombas' classic comfort features, from keeping cool and dry on your morning run to staying comfortable in your office's freezing air conditioning. These socks are ready to work as hard as you do. And for every pair of socks you buy, Bombas will donate a pair to somebody in need. Bombas are what feet daydream about. Yeah, I said it. It's true. Buy your Bombas at bombas.com/Rome today and get 20% off your first purchase. These socks are absolutely incredible. That's BOMBAS.com/Rome for 20% off. Bombas.com/Rome. All right, so the Nationals are now one win away from the World Series. Let me repeat that. The Washington Nationals are a single win away from the World Series. This is not a drill. This is not a joke. This is real. After last night's beatdown on St. Louis, 8-1, this series is, in fact, over. I mean, technically, there's still at least one more game to be played. Theoretically, I guess, the Cards could come back to win it. You can hit that with the old cliche that stranger things have happened. But St. Louis coming back in this series, down 3-0, would be one of the strangest things ever. Almost as strange as the Nats going from being perennial postseason tanks to a postseason juggernaut almost overnight. Almost as strange as the Nationals going from being nearly knocked out in the wild card game to knocking out the Dodgers and then being on the verge of sweeping out the Cards. Almost as strange as the Nationals going from being under 500 in May to, never mind, that one's been beaten into the ground. But here's the thing that bears repeating. Washington has got that look. The look of a team that's peaking at exactly the right time. The look of a team that if you give them an inch, as the Cardinals did last night in the third inning, they're going to rip the whole mile. And their fans. Man, are you kidding me? Fans who used to come to the park expecting the worst are now expecting the best? But why wouldn't they? And who cares about the bullpen that is allegedly the worst bullpen in postseason history? When you've got starting pitchers carrying no hitters deep into the game, on the road, and you've got Steven Strasburg striking out 12 and walking nobody in Game 3, man, who cares who the arsonists are in the bullpen? Who cares which arsonist drags his gas can to the bump? It doesn't matter when you've got that starting pitching. Even if Strasburg was not able to replicate Anibal Sanchez and Max Scherzer in terms of carrying that no-hitter, it didn't matter what the Cards did last night. They were not getting this guy off the mound. Hell, his own manager could not get him out of the game. When Strasburg reached for his hamstring in the 7th, Martinez and the trainer went out to check on him, and that was a big mistake.
Yeah, I was trying to explain to him, hey, you just grabbed your hamstring. So there's a little concern. He goes, no, I cramped up. I'm fine. I always cramp up. And I said, I'm staying in the game. I want to finish this inning. So I said, you sure you're all right? And he said, I'm in the game.
I love starters who, when the manager comes out, they look at them like, what the hell do you want? Oh, hell no. Like it's a personal affront. Like, I didn't sit there. I don't have office hours. Get the hell out of my office. What are you doing here? What do you want, old man? I'm trying to do some work. Hey, no problem. So he talks his way into staying in the game. And not only was he in the game, he struck out the next two batters. But last night was not just about Strasburg. It was also about Howard Joseph Kendrick III, professional hitter. The guy who single-handedly ended the Dodgers in Game 5, just ended the Cards in Game 3. Let's go to the third inning, because that's the inning where it all fell apart for St. Louis. Victor Robles led off with a single. Strasburg dropped down a perfect bunt to move him to second. That was followed by a strikeout, and it was then that all hell broke loose. Adam Eaton singled to score Robles, then Anthony Rendon came up.
Swing and a line drive toward the left field line, chasing Ozuna toward the line, closing, slides, he dropped the ball! Eaton's trying to score! Ozuna's throw to the plate is not in time! The Nationals lead 2-0!
Nats Radio. And the thing about Ozuna, he's not some hack out there. This guy's a gold glove winner, but couldn't make that play. Eaton scores. Juan Soto walks. And then, following a wild pitch, Howie Kendrick steps in, and he does this.
Swing a line drive right center field. That's a base hit. It's up the gap. It's going to the wall. Rendon scores. Soto scores. Howie Kendrick clears the bases with a two-run double here in the third inning. They are delirious at Nationals Park. It's 4-0.
This dude's something else. 36 and still doing things like that. 4-0 Nats. That game was done. The Cards were done. But Kendrick was not. Here's Kendrick in the fifth.
And now the pitch to Kendrick. Swung on it, Belden, to the gap in left center field. This one is down to a roll to the wall. Rounding second, Rendon heading for third. The ball not picked up by Ozuna. Rendon waved home. Will score standing easily without a play as the ball just comes in from left center field. Howie Kendrick has done it again.
Kendrick scored to make it 6-0. Then he scored again in the seventh to make it 8-1. Kendrick has played 9 games in this postseason. He's got 9 RBI and 5 runs. The guy's becoming an absolute legend in the district. Or, as Anthony Rendon said,
he's the greatest ever. I mean, you see the man. He's, what, 36 years old, and he's still doing it. He's built like a freaking cinder block. He's huge. But, man, he stays short. I mean, he's strong. So if he puts that barrel to it and he stays inside the ball, I mean, you've seen it. He does damage. And so he knows how to hit, and that's what he does.
That's awesome. That was a great explanation. Rendon was then asked what he would be doing at age 36.
Hopefully not playing baseball. Probably sitting on the couch hanging out with my kids. He's probably going to play for another 20 years.
I mean, that would not shock me if he did. And then you'd have a 56-year-old Kendrick raking. And the way the Nats are playing right now, they'll still be winning then also. They're now 1 win away from the World Series. Man, you talk about a narrative that changed quickly. Can I repeat that? The Washington Nationals are 1 win away from being in the World Series. Some of the biggest postseason chumps ever are now cold-blooded assassins. And they're 1 win away. And I would not get too caught up in this whole narrative that the ALCS is for the de facto championship. Man, can you really still be sleeping on the Nats? The way they're playing and the way they're starting pitching is showing up. Credit where credit's due. Put some respect on them. They're 1 win away. 1 win away from the World Series. Lonto Griffin is my guest. Lonto, good to have you on. How are you?
Great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Really good to have you. In fact, I've been looking forward to it because of your journey, and I want to get into that. But if we talk first about what happened in Houston, you've had a few days for it to sink in. How does it feel to know that you're a PGA winner, and does it feel the way you thought it would?
Oh, that's a good question. It's been a whirlwind. There's just so many things going through my head, constantly waking up at 4 a.m. and not being able to get back to sleep. But yeah, just knowing that I got some job security for the next, 3 years out here on the PGA Tour. And I mean, this is 100% my dream job. I don't want to do anything else. And just knowing that I'm going to be starting the year out in Maui at the Century Tournament of Champions and the Players Championship and the Masters, there's just so much to be excited about.
Lonto Griffin joining us. I know exactly what you're talking about because I know the backstory, but for those who don't know, I want to go back and I want to be really sensitive about this because there's a lot of emotion attached to it, but it's really inspiring. You were born in Mount Shasta, California, and you moved to Virginia. The story goes that your mom, Julie, was a gardener and your father, Michael, ran a health food store. But as you've said, your dad would always rather spend time with you and your siblings and coached your baseball and soccer teams. So what were those days like for you growing up?
Oh, they were amazing. Yeah, my dad wouldn't, he wouldn't miss an opportunity to throw a catch with me in the yard or go to a soccer game. And we just had a lot of love. I mean, my mom has a master's in teaching, but she was a stay-at-home mom, and we did homeschooling for a while. But I was addicted to sports. Anything with a ball at an early age, football, soccer, basketball. I wasn't huge into golf, but we grew up next to a 9-hole golf course in Blacksburg, Virginia, and it was called The Hill. And I'd go over there and play all day, 36, 45. I think it was $9 to play all day. And so I kind of fell in love with it there, and my dad, before he passed away, got me hooked up with the local country club, Blacksburg Country Club, and Steve Prater kind of took me under his wing. And when my dad passed away, he gave me a full membership, and the rest is history. I used golf to kind of as an outlet, kind of get away from the tragedy that hit me, and it was just awesome to be able to focus on getting really good at golf versus, you know, the kind of the negative stuff that I'd gone through at kind of a vulnerable age. So everything happens for a reason, and it's just kind of a good example of how to turn a negative into a positive.
I really appreciate that response. Lonto Griffin is my guest. I want to make sure that the listeners understand what we're talking about here. Your father bought you a starter set of clubs for Christmas in 1996. He passed away from a brain tumor when you were just 12. How would you describe your father and the impact he had on you? What was he like?
Just loving. I mean, it's tough to talk about, but just a great dad and everything you ever want.
Lonto Griffin, my guest, I know it. And that's why I wanted to treat this with the kind of respect that it really deserves. But you mentioned Steve Prater. You mentioned Steve Prater, and he was the head pro at Blacksburg Country Club. He reached out to you. What was his message to you, and what kind of a role has he played in all of this?
He's been like a fill-in dad. I mean, we've had so many conversations over the years, and anytime in sports, there's always doubts, and you need those. You know that you need the stables. There's always criticism, whether you're having a bad stretch or you don't believe in yourself. You need those people in sports to believe in you, and that's always been what I've had with Steve. And nobody's believed in my game and talent more than he has, and he's shown it. I mean, he's never charged me for less than 17 years. That's very rare. He's never asked for anything, and the starting of this PGA Tour season. You know, I finally realized it's time to start giving back to him, and so I put him on payroll before the Greenbrier, the first thing he said was, you know, don't think this means you can treat me like an employee, because, you know, so we've had our relationship is special, and we get along great, and so the fact that I've got off to a great start and won this week, it's really cool to give back to not only Steve but all the other people that have made my career possible, because growing up, you know, we didn't have a ton of money, but we had all the love in the world, and a lot of people are part of my journey, and that's kind of the cool part. You know, I won on Sunday, but I got off the course and had 700 text messages, and being able to, you know, look at the people that opened their wallets for me in amateur golf and mini tours for 7 years, to, you know, just kind of share this win with them, it kind of validates that, you know, they made the right decision and believing in me, and that's that means more to me than the win itself.
Lonto Griffin is joining us. You know, when you talk about those who believed in you, you'll always remember those who had your back and those who did believe. The story goes that you wanted to play at Virginia Tech, but they didn't have a spot for you. How challenging a time was that?
It was tough. I mean, you know, I grew up a huge, you know, Virginia Tech Elkie fan. I still am. They just didn't work out. They didn't have, there was no seniors leaving the year I was coming in. And it just, I had my heart set on it. That was the only place I wanted to go. And it didn't work out. But Matt Ball at VCU, he came to me and he offered me a full scholarship. And honestly, getting out of my comfort zone, going to a large city compared to what I grew up in Blacksburg, I think it made me grow up, you know, being away from family and VCU is an incredible school. Obviously, everybody knows them for basketball, but it's just a tight-knit community. And I think, it's, like I said earlier, everything works out for the right reason. And I wouldn't change it for the world.
Right. I've also heard you say that actually was the best thing that could have happened to you because, among other things, at VCU, you learned how to work. You learned how to grind. You got your work ethic there. What do you remember about that time there, and what did you learn about work ethic at VCU?
Yeah, so freshman year, I was I wasn't ready for the big stage. You know, college athletics is—it's no joke. I mean, the players are great, and I had a teammate, you know, Mark Jargon from Sweden, come in my sophomore year. He was a freshman, and we're best friends to this day. But that kid worked. You know, he worked so darn hard in the gym and practicing that it almost pissed the rest of those players off because he made us look bad. The coach, he was a freshman coming in and outworking everybody. And I say outworking, I don't mean an extra 30 minutes a day. I'm talking, you know, getting to the gym an hour before the rest of the team does so he can get a full workout in and get into the range on off days and grinding. So in the beginning, it was kind of like, you know, what's this kid doing? He's making me look bad. And then I kind of realized this guy's a genius, and I learned a ton from him. And it was actually his birthday on Sunday in Houston when I won. So, and he told me that was the best birthday present he could ever imagine. But I owe him a lot. My work ethic. You know, everybody thinks they work hard, until they meet somebody that works harder than they do. And there's always somebody that's going to work harder than you. And luckily I learned that in college, because if I hadn't learned it in college, I wouldn't, you know, there's no way I'd be where I am today.
Preach. I mean, that's the absolute truth. Lonzo Griffin joining us. You know, I can go on and on with this story, but you won in places like South America and on the Corn Ferry Tour, but... And you had to keep grinding this thing out. You got a PGA Tour card, and then it didn't work out. And then you went back to the Corn Ferry Tour, and there's a story about you being at a dinner in Bahamas, or in the Bahamas, and Greg Norman spoke. What do you remember about what he said, and what was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, we were. It was at Exuma, and Greg Norman designed the golf course there, and he's a big influence in golf. And I just listened to him. He was giving a talk, and I think somebody asked him, you know, what do you look for in young players? And his response was, I don't look for the guys that are winning and then missing five cuts in a row, or, you know, just that Cinderella story. He's like, I look for the guys that are constantly finishing top 20, top 15, throwing a win here, but the consistency. And immediately I started thinking back to my first year on the Corn Ferry Tour. You know, I had a win. I had like maybe one or two other top 10s, but I had a lot of 50, 60, 70th place finishes that, you know, those weeks are tough because you don't make up much traction on the year. And going to the PGA Tour last year, same thing. You know, I had one top 25. I had a lot of, you know, I think I made 13 or 14 cuts, but majority of those finishes were bottom of the pack. So when I heard Greg say that, it kind of rang a bell, and I started thinking, what do I need to do to be consistently finishing, you know, top 25 on an average week? And you know, it came down to short game, and it came down to, you know, grinding out every week, every shot. And the Corn Ferry Tour this season, I think I had 11 top 22s, and to have five top 20s and a win to start the PGA Tour season, man, huge shout out to Greg Norman. That was just, you never know, you know, when you say something, it can resonate in certain people. And listening to a legend say that, it struck a bell with me, and I'm going to run with it.
Lonzo Griffin, my guest for another moment or so. You know, you reached a point where you were actually down to $176 to your name. We talked about your dad. One of the goals back in the day was to make enough money to buy your mom a car. What's it like knowing that you can do that now? And have the two of you picked one out yet?
She's a Subaru, you know, for life, and she's never had a Subaru. I don't think she's ever had even a new used car, so it's going to be pretty cool. We're working on the details now, but it's going to be a Subaru Outback or a Subaru Forester, and to be able to see the look on her face when I hand the keys over to her is going to be that's going to be a memory I'll never forget.
He won the Houston Open on Sunday for his first career PGA Tour win, number one in the FedEx Cup standings, top 20s in all five starts this year. Lonzo Griffin, my guest. My man, really nice to have you on the show. Congrats. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I hope we can do it again soon, Lonzo.
Thanks, man. I'm a huge fan of your show, and I appreciate you having me on.
I promised phone calls this segment. I will take telephone calls this segment. Let's start in Michigan. Scott, good to have you. Scott, how are you?
I'm doing well, Rome. How are you doing?
I'm great. Good to have you.
Appreciate you taking my call. I've been listening to the show since 99 when I was down in the Air Force down in Shreveport. Got in the jungle and never got out.
Appreciate that so much, Scott. Thank you.
You know, I originally called in to go off on the refs here. But what I'm finding out is you've pretty much covered everything other than the fact that on the way into the game, they were handing out eye dilations for them. I was watching the Miami game. That actually was more entertaining than any other game this weekend, which says a lot. Matt from Wisconsin called and says, oh, I'm a Green Bay fan, and we had bad calls against us, too. When? In what year? In what decade have you had a bad call in a Lions game? Shut up and sit down, Matt. LeVar, your toothpaste. What in the heck are you doing with your toothpaste? It comes out of the container to brush your teeth. Maybe you should try it sometime. I mean, watching these games, it's kind of like getting a colonoscopy, only worse. These refs were so terrible, they couldn't even find their... Oh, lost it, Rome. Sorry, I'm out.
My man. Scott, why did you do that? What are you talking about, Scott? You were killing the game. My man, that was perfectly smooth sailing. Why did you off yourself like that? Scott, thank you for your service, first of all. I was going to let you go as long as you wanted to go. I was reaching for a golden ticket. There is nothing that you could have done other than what you did to end that call. Alvin was not going to bring the hammer down, and I was absolutely mesmerized by your takes. Man, takes for days.
Good night now!